Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. If you've spent any time at all watching or reading about American politics lately, well, you've probably run into the same wall. Why does everything feel so charged, so hostile?
Like a constant cultural war, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why is it so tribal? And why does it seem like facts just bounce off? Today, we're diving deep into Ezra Klein's really important book, Why We're Polarized.
It's such a necessary read, I think. Our goal here isn't just to point fingers, you know, it's to actually get under the hood and understand the mechanics of why things are the way they are.
Right. We want to tackle that big question that trips so many people up. Why is it that even when you make a really solid evidence-based argument, it almost never seems to change anyone's mind anymore?
Yeah, and the easy answer, the one you hear all the time, is, well, people are just irrational, or stubborn, or maybe even bad.
But Klein flips that, doesn't he? He offers something, well, pretty counterintuitive.
He really does. The core idea, the sort of headline insight from the book, is that the problem isn't just the people. It's the system.
The system.
Yeah, the way our political parties are set up, the media environment, our institutions. They've kind of changed in ways that actively weaponize our natural human tendency to form groups. The system itself encourages the tribalism.
So it's taking our basic psychology and amplifying it.
Right.
Turning political identity into what he calls a mega identity.
Precisely. Making compromise feel almost unnatural, even dangerous to people.
Okay, before we unpack that, let's talk about the author, Ezra Klein. He's a familiar name to many, right?
Definitely. He's a major voice, co-founder of Vox, you know, really known for that explainer journalism style. And now he's a columnist at the New York Times, a big platform.
So what makes his take on this so valuable? He's a journalist, not necessarily an academic political scientist, but the book feels incredibly well-researched.
I think his real strength is synthesis. He's brilliant at translating complex academic work from political science, sociology, psychology, you name it, into a clear, accessible story.
He connects the dots.
Exactly. He takes all this dense research and makes it make sense in the context of, you know, the political chaos we see every day. He gives structure to the noise.
And it feels like he's approaching it less like a partisan trying to win an argument and more like a doctor trying to diagnose an illness. The authority comes from the evidence he weaves together.
Yeah, he's really aiming for a kind of unified theory of polarization, trying to explain the why.
Okay, so let's get into the overview of that theory. The main thrust is that this polarization isn't just about people suddenly becoming more unreasonable. It's systemic.
Right, and he takes us on this layered journey. He argues you really have to start with the human brain, our basic psychology, that deep need to belong to a group.
A groupish brains, as he puts it.
Yeah.
Then he moves through history, looking at this huge sorting process that realigned American society. And then he looks at how our media and political institutions are kind of pouring gasoline on that fire.
And a key thing to grasp up front, he says, is that the period lots of people look back on fondly, you know, the mid-20th century, when there seemed to be more compromise, that was the weird part.
That was the anomaly, exactly. Back then, the parties were weaker, more diverse internally. What's happened over the last, say, 60 years is this great sorting, as he calls it, which has created two incredibly distinct, internally homogenous tribes.
Tribes that basically see each other as enemies.
And in that environment, gridlock isn't a mistake. It's almost the logical outcome for both sides. Compromise becomes incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
Okay, let's dig into that, starting with the psychology. Our groupish brains. What's the core idea there? How basic is this tribal instinct?
Oh, it's incredibly basic. He talks about the minimal group paradigm from social psychology. It's fascinating and kind of depressing, actually.
Also, researchers found that you can create group loyalty based on the most trivial things, like literally telling people they're in the group that prefers one abstract painting over another, or just randomly assigning them a red or blue shirt. Instantly, people favor their own group.
Wow. So we're just hardwired to pick a side even if the sides are meaningless.
Pretty much. It's likely an evolutionary thing, right? Survival depended on sticking with your tribe. And modern politics, it taps directly into that ancient wiring.
How does it do that?
Well, politics raises the stakes. Everything feels existential. When that happens, policy disagreements aren't just about policy anymore. They become us versus them. An attack on your party, or even just criticism of it, feels like a personal attack, like a threat to your actual identity.
Which explains why facts often don't get through. You're not debating facts. You're defending your tribe, yourself.
Exactly. Your brain's threat detection system is firing.
Okay, so we have this basic instinct. But how did it get so perfectly channeled into our political identities? That brings us to the Great Sorting. What kicked that off?
Klein pinpoints the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as the main catalyst. A really pivotal moment. It started this huge, slow-motion realignment.
How did that work?
Well, basically, racially conservative white Democrats, especially in the South, started shifting towards the Republican Party over decades. But that initial sorting based on race and civil rights created a kind of gravitational pull.
It pulled other identities along with it.
Yeah. Over time, other identities started aligning too. Religion, where you lived, urban versus rural, there are even things like education level, lifestyle choices. They all started sorting along partisan lines.
So being a Democrat or Republican started to say a lot more about you than just your views on government spending. It became a signal about your whole cultural world.
Precisely. Where you shop, what you watch, who your friends are. It all correlates much more strongly with party ID now than it did 50 or 60 years ago. We're sorted.
And this sorted population then encountered a radically different media environment. Talk about that.
Right. Think back to, say, the 1960s or 70s. You basically had three TV networks everyone watched. They presented a broadly shared reality, a common set of facts.
I mean, Walter Cronkite, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Now, it's completely fragmented. Cable news, talk radio, blogs, social media. Everyone can exist in their own information bubble.
Separate ecosystems.
Totally separate. And crucially, the business model, especially online, thrives on engagement. And what drives engagement?
Outrage, emotion.
Bingo. Outrage, anger, fear. The algorithms learn what pushes your buttons, what keeps you scrolling and clicking, and it's often stuff that confirms your biases and makes you angry at the other side. It reinforces the tribalism for profit.
Which feeds right into this idea of the political mega identity.
Mm.
Because all these other identities, race, religion, geography, culture, are now aligned with party.
Mm.
Your political identity becomes kind of the master identity.
It becomes the umbrella identity that encompasses all the others for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises the stakes astronomically.
Rousseau.
Because if your party is your tribe, representing your culture, your values, your people, then an election isn't just about who gets to set tax policy. It feels like an existential battle for the soul of the country.
A clash between two fundamentally different ways of life.
Exactly. Losing feels devastating, like your whole world is under threat. Winning feels like survival. That makes compromise seem like betrayal.
And that brings us to this system itself, the crisis of an unresponsive system. Klein points out this paradox. Institutions like the Senate, the filibuster, they were meant to encourage compromise, right?
Right.
But now they seem to just cause paralysis.
Yeah, it's a crucial point. These structures, the Electoral College, the Senate giving Wyoming the same power as California, the filibuster requiring supermajorities, they were designed in an era of weak parties.
Parties that were internally diverse, messy coalitions.
Right. The idea was to slow things down, force different factions within the parties and between the parties to bargain. They were speed bumps, veto points to cool passions.
But what happens when the parties are no longer messy coalitions, but these highly disciplined, ideologically pure tribes we just talked about?
Then those same structures don't force compromise anymore. They just give the minority party tremendous power to obstruct everything. They become tools for gridlock.
Which just makes people angrier and more cynical about the system.
Exactly. It fuels the very frustration and polarization it was perhaps originally intended to manage. It becomes a vicious cycle. The system designed for one reality is breaking down in our current reality.
And Klein also mentions something called asymmetric polarization. What's that about? It's not just equal on both sides.
Well, the data he presents suggests that while both parties have definitely moved away from the center, the Republican Party has moved further to the right and become more fundamentally oppositional to the current state and demographic trends.
Why is that?
He argues, based on the research, that part of it is driven by demographic anxiety. The party's core base, historically white Christians, sees their cultural and demographic dominance declining, and that feels like an existential threat. This fuels a more defensive, rejectionist stance toward compromise in institutions.
So that asymmetry makes finding common ground even harder.
It certainly complicates things, yeah.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. Let's try to pull out the big overarching themes. What's the first key message someone should take away?
I think the absolute foundation is identity trumps ideology. Politics today, Klein argues, is fundamentally driven by group identity, not reasoned policy debates.
Our policy views often come after our group loyalty.
Often, yeah. They're like rationalizations for why our team is right and their team is wrong. So that means if you're trying to win someone over purely with facts and figures, well, you're probably missing the real driver. You're challenging their identity, not just their opinion.
That's sobering.
Okay.
Theme number two.
Negative partisanship. This is huge. It means that a lot of political energy and motivation today comes less from loving your own side and more from hating or fearing the other side.
So it's more about opposing them than supporting us.
For many engaged partisans, yes. Fear and anger are powerful motivators. Just think about your own media habits, maybe. How often do you click on or share a story about how awful the other side is versus a story about something positive your side is doing? The negative stuff often travels faster and further.
Guilty as charged sometimes.
Okay.
Theme three, this one feels very relevant to our times, the information feedback loop.
Right. We used to think, maybe naively, that more information would lead to more consensus, more rationality. The internet would save us.
Yeah, that didn't quite pan out.
No. Klein shows that in our polarized environment, more information often just gives partisans more ammunition to defend their existing beliefs. They get better at arguing their side, not necessarily better at finding objective truth.
So the most informed people can actually become the most polarized.
That's what the evidence suggests. They're skilled at motivated reasoning, selectively using information to confirm what they already believe.
Wow. So all these themes really point back to the core idea. These are systemic problems. Shouting, "Can't we all just get along?" isn't going to cut it.
Pretty much. Civility is nice, but Klein's point is that the incentives within the system, in media, in party primaries, in Congress, often reward polarization and punish moderation. You need systemic solutions for systemic problems.
The book is full of really sharp, memorable lines that capture these ideas. Let's highlight a few.
Okay.
How about this one on the institutions? The American political system isn't broken. It's doing what it was designed to do, but that design is now breaking us.
Yeah, that nails the paradox, doesn't it? The system's features, the veto points, the checks and balances worked differently when parties were weak. Now, with strong polarized parties, those same features lead to stalemate and public rage. The design is mismatched to the reality.
And the one about information we just touched on, maybe paraphrased, the more information partisans get, the more they disagree.
It's so counterintuitive, but it highlights how knowledge gets weaponized in these identity conflicts. It's used for battle, not for bridge building. You become a better debater for your side, not necessarily closer to the truth.
And a final one that really explains the power of fear in politics. In the face of threat, people don't abandon their groups. They double down on them.
That's key. It explains why rhetoric about threats, demographic threats, cultural threats, economic threats, is so effective. It doesn't make people question their leaders. It makes them rally around them even tighter. Loyalty intensifies under perceived attack. So, okay, this framework is powerful, maybe a bit depressing. But how can you, listening now, actually use these insights? What are the real-life applications?
Good question. Where do we start?
I think the first step is just personal self-awareness, really internalizing this idea of motivated reasoning.
Meaning noticing when you're doing it.
Exactly. When you feel that flash of anger reading a headline or that surge of satisfaction seeing the other side look bad, care. Pause. Ask yourself, is this a reasoned response to the substance? Or is my tribal identity just being activated? Is this my groupish brain reacting?
Just being aware of that impulse can help temper it.
It's a start. Second tip. Smarter media consumption. Consciously fight the outrage machine. Remember that clicks equal profit and outrage generates clicks.
So don't just live in the echo chamber.
Actively seek out sources that challenge your views, that come from outside your tribe. It's uncomfortable, but it's necessary to get a fuller picture and resist just having your biases confirmed 24/7.
Okay, and maybe the most practical behavioral change Klein suggests, cultivating cross-cutting identities.
Yes, this is about intentionally investing time and energy in communities or activities that aren't primarily political.
Like what? A book club, a sports team, volunteering locally?
Exactly. Things where you build relationships with people based on a shared interest other than politics. When you know people from the other side as real human beings, as fellow hikers, or parents at your kid's school, or members of your church or volunteer group, it gets a lot harder to just see them as monstrous caricatures.
It breaks down the abstraction of the enemy.
Right. It helps, as Klein puts it, depoliticize our lives a bit, reduce the overwhelming power of that single partisan identity by strengthening other parts of who we are. So, wrapping up, what's the biggest thing I took away from revisiting this book? For me, it's that fundamental shift in perspective. It makes you less judgmental, maybe, of individual
How
voters.
so?
Well, instead of just thinking those people are crazy, you start seeing how the system, the media incentives, the party sorting, the institutional rules actively pushes people into these corners. It encourages you to be more critical of the structures and maybe a bit more understanding of the individuals caught within them.
Yeah, that resonates. For me, the big light bulb moment was seeing figures like, well, Donald Trump, not as the cause of all this polarization, but more as a product and an accelerant of it.
Perfectly suited for the environment.
Exactly. He thrived in this deeply sorted, identity-driven, high-conflict environment where loyalty to the leader and antagonism towards the out-group mattered more than anything else.
And it reinforces Klein's point. The way forward isn't just about wishing for nicer politicians. It's likely about reforming the rules of the game, changing those systemic incentives.
The book really is a powerful diagnosis. And, understanding the illness is always the first step toward finding effective treatment.
A truly essential diagnosis for our times. Definitely worth a deep dive. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.